Gator, let's take a moment and say thank you to our sponsors at Fuji Sport.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've been working with us for a very long time, not only on this podcast, but also at the Academy. And I'm taking a peek at their website right now, and they have a brand new ultralight gi. Now, this is mind-blowing. I'm looking at my size. A2 is 2.75 pounds. I mean, that's under 3 pounds. That's mind-blowing.
I could even lift that. And go to their website, fujisports.com. Check it out. Anything you can need for your jiu-jitsu journey, you can find at fujisports.com.
Hey, it's been a while since we started Roll TV Project.
It's been a while since you started it. I did come in later, and I can't say enough about it, especially the new platform. It's really amazing, fully customizable, and you know a little bit more about the structure.
Well, so two things you need to know. One is the subscription service, which is $9 a month. You can get access to hundreds of videos, hundreds of drills, techniques, and so on in a very nice library categorized as you need them. But two different lessons. You can actually purchase those individually, and you own them, so the subscription is not tied to it at all. You can look at things like spider guard, half guard sweeps, half guard chokes, folding pass, and so on. There's so many of them out there. So take a look and see where you need help with the videos, right? 30%. If you type in Roll Radio as a code.
Who doesn't like saving money? Go to rollacademy.tv. What's up, everyone, and welcome back. If you haven't already, please remember to hit the like, share, subscribe, download, listen, and whatever other button there is, and leave us a review wherever you do listen. That ensures that we can continue bringing you the great guests and amazing content that you have come to expect. Scott Georgakis is a strength and conditioning coach for top-level athletes, including members of the Olympic judo team and Olympic judo silver medalist and John Danaher black belt, Travis Stevens. On this episode, Scott discusses growing up in a wrestling family, the wrestling versus jiu-jitsu mindset, having Travis Stevens as a coach, how to have longevity in jiu-jitsu, the importance of sleep, getting comfortable in the extremes, and so much more. Here is the Roll Radio with massage therapist, strength and conditioning coach, wilderness guide, and BJJ purple belt, Scott Georgakis.
Welcome to Roll Radio.
And we're live. Gary, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
Are you great? I'm not great.
Why not?
I had a long weekend, man. What? I'm super tired.
That's what happens when you're 70, you're partying away.
Yeah.
What did you do?
I stayed up late. All over in the city, running around, checking out the river. The river is amazing now.
You didn't drown.
I did not. I'm still here. ate way too much barbecue. Like, my diet is just awful right now. And so I'm just super sluggish and slow. Mm. But I think we have a good guest who's going to hopefully turn all that around. Mm. So,
are you falling apart?
I'm always falling. I've been falling apart. That started well before the weekend.
That was a rhetorical question.
Yes. Yes, I am falling apart. But let's put it back together. I'm excited.
Is that what it is? Are you training this week?
Yeah, absolutely. I was on the mat yesterday. Sluggish, so. That might have something to do with it, too. I was on the mat yesterday. I've had this little elbow thing going. But it's just sore now. So it's not like injured or anything. It's just sore. And yesterday was great to get back on the mat after a week.
Yeah.
Resting it. So yeah.
Did you get smashed?
Of course. Yeah. Shout out to Russ who tapped me. He was like, your elbow's bothering you. I said, yeah. So he immediately arm dragged me, put me in an omoplata on that arm, wrist locked me, and then said he was sorry. But so as long as he apologized for it, I guess it's good. But that's Russ for you. And then today he shows up wearing a t-shirt that said, it said Dirty Grappler on it. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. He is. That was very apropos.
Shout out to Ross. Yeah.
So should we get started here?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Scotty, great to see you. Welcome to the show. How you been?
Great to be here. Good.
I mentioned this right before we start recording, but you know, I felt kind of offended when you got on BJJ Fanatics with Bernardo and you posted a video for guys over 50. And I'm like, well, delete, next. You get rid of that guy.
You need it.
Yeah. You need it. No. How has been your jiu-jitsu? You coming in, we'll get to your expertise in a moment, but I'm curious to, you have an interesting story altogether, a life story, you know, take us back a little bit and who in the world are you? We get to the point of the show.
I grew up in a wrestling family. So all uncles are Olympic alternate, Cornell wrestlers. And I grew up in that culture and in high school and a little bit in college. So that was background. Was also a wilderness survival guide before that. Spent a lot of time. We can go into that later. As far as it relates to profession, started strength and conditioning, and I got Travis Stevens as one of my athletes, and we traded. I traded him every day, training him in therapy and in strength and conditioning, and he showed me jujitsu in exchange. So it was a very like one-on-one learning from him, and so it was very personal, and just absolutely fell in love. And been doing it ever since.
Yeah, I mean, we've had Travis while back at this point, right?
Yeah, it was a long time ago, but we talked to him. But he did it from time to time.
No, absolutely. And to this point, he's one of the most listened episodes.
Yeah, and he gets every time somebody passes him, he gets really upset.
slightly competitive. So, yeah,
he is slightly. What's he like? What's he like as an instructor? Because I've been to seminars, but on a one-on-one basis or on a regular basis, maybe a better way to put it. What's he like as an instructor?
I mean, it depends who you are. He's an incredible coach. He's very, he molds to how you learn best, like any good coach. And for me, kind of that wrestling headspace, you know, we enjoy getting told that we suck, is kind of the motivating factor. You know, that you're not good enough in a position, you kind of like, you idiot, go over here and then you fix it. So he's very harsh criticism wise, but incredibly detailed. You know, he comes off as a brawler in a lot of ways, and he can, but is so, so detail oriented, like any of the really top level judo guys. But incredible learning under him.
Some might even say that it's not only the judo guys, but you know, any of the professional athletes to that level, right? Gary and I, we talked about this often on this show and just in general, but there's always levels to all of this, you know, levels to the coaches and levels to the athletes. And you got, hobbyist, and then guys who do this for a living, and then you got guys professional, and then there's above professional, like they're the top dogs, the guys that it's just there's nothing above them, right? There's no ceiling for these guys, and just the mental state, how they navigate through coaching and being an athlete is just sometimes mind blowing, like. Sometimes I read the books or watch or listen to these guys, scratch my head, like, how in the world? And you had privilege to deal with a lot of people all throughout your profession. Is that right?
Yeah. The super type A Olympic, I mostly deal with individual athletes. So whether that's, like a track and field skeleton, Olympic skeleton, it's always individuals. I work with them way better. They're so type A, and I'm so opposite that. It works really well, like having someone to just get them to calm down and relax and take that time, to just take a day off is usually what I'm the best at. It's just with Travis, I just take him out to the woods and we go hunting, get him completely away from jujitsu, and just for 2 days, because they're so intense down that those top five guys, that highest level is such an OCD, you know, you have to be able to train every day and do the same thing every day for years and years and years, especially with the Olympics.
So for those who are not familiar with what you do, quickly give us a kind of recap. You work with these athletes, professional athletes, but what exactly do you do?
It's kind of like a one-stop shop. So I have a hands-on license with massage therapy and a bunch of other like hands-on modalities, like shiatsu and rolfing and then for any body work, you know, I also know the community. So if I have to refer out, I'm that kind of like that central guy. And then, you know, we do, strength and conditioning, but a lot of it's, you know, kind of going back to the wilderness side of stuff. It's just like grounding and centering, getting them, you know, outside, breathing exercises, ice bath, everything everything outside of judo, besides like high level sports psychology. I like to refer that out to, we have a couple sports psychologists that are like very dialed in. So I don't go there. That's all there. Besides that, everything.
What's the best part of the job?
I mean, I get so much out of it, and like, this, I got jujitsu out of it. Like I couldn't ask for more, you know, private lessons from people like that, just seeing how they think about the world and their headspace. Not that I want to spend time inside their brain, but you learn just mental models and systems thinking from them so well. You know, it's an incredible barter to be able to work with them.
Let me get this straight. So first you get on the mat, you get beat up. Then you're trying to correct the guys. And then if that doesn't work, you take them out in the woods.
Exactly. Deep into the woods. Yeah. That's it.
Let's pivot to the beginning. Let's go back to the beginning one more time. So what's up with this wilderness? I know your background story, but many don't. Mm-hmm. Why is everything reaching back to that nature? Why is everything reaching back to the woods, the kind of disconnecting from the reality of life?
Yeah. So as a kid, my family moved around 9 times from the age of like, you know, before I was 12. So, you know, the woods was really only consistent. We were all rural. So the only place that I really had to like really connect, the place that was consistent was the woods. And by the age of 13, 14, I was spending most of my time there. You know, high school, I didn't spend much time in high school. It was, you know, me and my sister, we skied the length of Vermont, like 900 miles, and then built a wood canvas canoe and took it back down the Connecticut River and spent time in Ecuador, just in the mountains. It was very much like envisioning in the future, kind of like the grungy climber. Or, you know, and was doing a lot of wilderness survival teaching. So I got opportunity to learn from a lot of those guys, ex-military guys up in Vermont and Catskill Mountains, New Hampshire, and like stalking, you know, how to disappear in the woods, kind of like the Seer School type stuff as a kid, and then began teaching it as I grew up with it, and then guiding up in the north as well. You know, that's kind of where everything for me goes back to as a coach. Being more of a guide in that sense was always more useful to me, that headspace, because it's really like navigating a wilderness and a path forward. And, you know, the job doesn't quit. The job doesn't stop when the athlete leaves the gym. You know, I'm waking these guys up in the morning. You know, you're there for everything. You're there to show the way. And you have to walk the talk too. So I'm the first one in the ice bath, unfortunately, when I'm coaching ice baths. You know, you're really setting the standard, and it's very hard to recover if you're not connected back to some sort of natural rhythm. You know, sitting in front of the TV and eating Cheetos, despite Travis's success doing just that.
Wow. All right. Wow.
I just found my clip.
Hold on.
We put out a sound clip every week. That's the one I'm using.
Let me call Travis right now.
You can tell he needs it. He needs it. Especially right now, man. But you know, it's individual per person, and taking him away from doing that on the weekends and just sticking him out in the woods in front of a fire instead, you know, increase the recovery rate. He was always broken. And then we started, you know, really emphasis, like putting a huge emphasis on recovery, and everything healed up.
Let me ask you an obvious question, because many students, many individuals out there, they think that coaches or instructors' job is to give all the answers. And you're talking about something completely different. As a matter of fact, that, you know, it, arguably you're going in the opposite direction. You're saying, I'm not going to give you any answers. My job is to kind of guide you or set you on self-discovery, if you will. Like this has to get resolved in your mind on your own, which is a huge contradiction to the typical state of mind that, or the expectation of the coach. What are your thoughts on that? Where efficient coach falls in relation to a student or to an athlete?
I think there's a big difference between what I'm talking about, and you hit right on it. Like the difference between, that's why I say guide instead of coach, because sports specific coach, like I got to show you, like, all right, this is our system, our 2-on-1 system from standing, right? This is exactly how it's executed. We need to learn exactly how to do it sports specific wise. And I know how to get you from point A to point B. I think that's the sports specific coach's job. And teaching jujitsu now, you know, I do that. And so it's a mental change for me. And strength and conditioning, I do it too. Like there's one way to do a clean, and we're going to do that way. You know, this is not a self-discovery. This is an arm drag. And then on the other side of things, it's, you know, you can't change people. All you can do is provide questions and then opportunities for experiential learning. So I think you have to go extremes on both sides. Either like Travis is teaching you and you don't figure out how to get your back flat, so he starts smashing you on the back with his fist. Or
wait,
you
know, what? You
know, yeah. He moves you into position. Uh-huh. It's the Danaher style. I hear he used to beat people with his cane. So, you know, he just moves you into position, or he uses, you know, intense cues, like, you know, put your chest on their face, or visual cues.
Yeah.
Tell you exactly what to do. Or, you know, you kind of set someone off in the middle of the woods and you're like, figure out how to make a fire. You know, this is up to you. It's a complete opposite coaching style, but I think both are super useful.
I think both play into jujitsu, don't they? I mean, in the beginning, you have to be that coach that tells you exactly what to do, exactly where to be. And then somewhere down the line, once you develop those skills, then it's self-discovery, right? Then you have a guide who's teaching you concepts instead.
Kit Dale, I think, was an interesting example of that for a little bit. His model of kind of like rolling to learn jujitsu seemed to be that kind of second one. But that white to blue belt learning, I think, is very like, okay, no, we have to do this.
Go ahead. Why is that mental state so important? Why do we really care? Why can't we just memorize things? Why can't we just, you tell me what to do, I execute. Who really cares about going out and relaxing in front of the fire and chilling?
Well, no one cares is the first one. When anyone asks what care is, one of my favorite quotes from a book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, is care is the external form of quality. So when you find someone who has care, you will find quality, and vice versa. So finding care and curiosity, I don't even know if you can find and cultivate it. I feel like it's somewhat of an innate trait, how much curiosity you have. I think you can work on it for sure, but like, I don't know if you can just suddenly, like, people like, how do I motivate myself? I'm like, hey, so that's kind of up to you. It's how much you care, and find something you care about, or it's going to be hard to be motivated. But I think, yeah, care is in the center of creating quality. So I think it's incredibly important.
So why do we care? Why is that mental space so important? Oh, we don't care. I don't know.
It's individual. Like, I don't think anyone cares but you personally about your own journey. I think we're all very, very, I mean, that's one of the things, like, it, working with these high level people, it's like, you have to love it. Like, no one else, every person in that crowd doesn't care about you. They're imagining themselves in your place.
But come on, Scott, everybody's looking at me. Everybody's cheering on for me or criticizing me. Come on. Yeah. Everybody cares. What are you talking about?
No, they don't.
Well, there you go.
That's one of the waking up things where it's like, hey, like, if you're not doing this for yourself, if you're not doing this because you care, go find something else. You know, find something that you care about, because that's, I mean, it's a purpose level, whatever you want to call it. I think without that care, it's very difficult without an immense amount of trauma. You know, that can be a mitigating factor. You can go through spit and vinegar and trauma and push through. You know, a lot of really amazing athletes have done that. That's a whole different conversation. But,
so what I'm hearing from you is, if one doesn't have enough self-motivation, there is really not much that coach or instructor can do to make them successful?
I mean, you can try, but it's really up to the individual. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like when you know, like a Gordon Ryan is a good example, the amount of effort that that person puts in, and you see this at any high level. You know, Gordon Ryan's just with the grappling. You hear about the Danaher, you know, Travis went to New York and learned from John and got his black belt in 18 months just because he was training all day, every day. To put in that kind of effort and not mentally break, you have to be able to care a lot. And I think part of that is that annoying word love, but you really have to love it. Based motivation, I think there are different ways to trick yourself into it. I think there are methods to do that, slowly increasing exercise, giving yourself a reward-based system, you know, like getting yourself out of being unhealthy. But again, we're talking levels, like to motivate yourself to that highest level. That's a whole different thing. If we're just talking about getting someone in the gym and getting them a little bit active and getting them healthy, that's a completely different conversation.
Yeah. And I recall the conversation with Travis when we had him here, when he talked about his Olympic experience and, you know, walking, whatever miles he walked to school, to the gym and back and forth and doing some of these ridiculous things without car and just waking up early and going after school and the whole thing that for most of us that is completely insane. Like, yeah. You know, for most of us, but then there is this handful of people out there who take it to that level and really go above and beyond. And I recently actually read about Michael Phelps and similar mental state of not only a physical performance, but then being the first one in the water, last one out of the pool, you know, and pushing above the limits of you know, mental state limitations to achieve the level of performance that he has achieved throughout his entire career, you know, and there is only one of them. Arguably the best out of the best, you know? So do you think that anybody can achieve that level of performance, or there is something that we are born with, that there's something that comes internally within us and we kind of embrace what we have or magnify what we already have, or this is built, this is purely built based on the experiences and choices that we've made?
I mean, that's the nature versus nurture thing. Like, I think it was an incredible behavioral psychology book called Behave. And one of the lines that I really liked is, the genetics are the gun, environment is the trigger. And so like, if the gun is there and you have a good trigger, then yes. But I think some people, you know, are missing a firing pin to some extent. With the genetic code. I mean, that's a harsh reality, but it's the truth. You know, it's saying you can do anything is a tricky statement.
No, you can't. I'll say this right now. No, you can't.
Yeah.
You
can't. No, you can't.
It's time to get honest.
You might think you do, but no, you can't.
But you can fulfill your specific potential to your genetics for sure. I think everyone has the potential to get to their potential and do your best, for sure. Now everyone's best is totally different, and there are a couple people that their best is going to be better than everyone else's.
And that's what's unfair, and I think that's very magnified in jiu-jitsu. I think that's very visible. It's more than I could be wrong because I don't play other sports, but I think it's very visible in jiu-jitsu where we see somebody who's training less and their success is much higher, you know, and they're getting much better, you know, and it's, I think partially is because jiu-jitsu is so difficult to measure and it's so difficult to comprehend the complexities of it. And it could vary based on my brain, your body, the circumstances that we find ourselves in, the environment, the coaches, our training partners, the schedules and all the other things that are happening. You know, but I think it's more visible. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's why I love individual sports. It shows you what someone's made out of. Because it's very much the amount of effort that you put in, you get out, and that's visible in everything else to some extent, but I mean, the combat sport specifically, like you really see what someone's made out of.
You think that jiu-jitsu is an individual sport?
In the sense that wrestling is, or that judo is, I think it's, or Muay Thai, you know, I almost find individual sport athletes better at teamwork because they have to create a team, and the other people in the team are working, like that person is the center of the team.
Yeah.
So they have to be nice and like create community, or no one's going to help them out because there's no incentive for that person to help them out. I don't think it's an individual sport by classification, but I don't think it's individual in essence.
So it takes a group to develop a person to become an individual sport athlete, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Is that, yeah. Absolutely. And your training partners. I mean, you could say it's a two-person sport almost.
Yeah.
Because of the amount of times that you're cooperative during training a day.
So how long you've been on the mat?
Doing jiu-jitsu 7 years now.
And then wrestled before that, how long?
Since I was little.
You're one of those guys, huh?
Yeah, well, with family too. But I was a little kid. I blew up in college physically. I was very small. So I wasn't successful, really in the grappling arts prior to like high school. I got a little bit bigger, but, until Travis, like it was subpar grappling the whole time. I got him because I was the individual guy at Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning, the gym. When his coach left, I took over, and by happenstance, he turned me into a good grappler, like without question.
In all forms. What was so pivotal about him that turned you into a good grappler?
He's an encyclopedia if this then that in general, like whether it comes to a problem solving master, whether it comes to chess, whether it comes to any grappling sport, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, and judo, all three, he completely changes his brain and can do it at a high level, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah. That was one of the things he brought up is like when he's wrestling and jiu-jitsu doesn't come into it. When he's doing judo, you know, it's just strictly judo. Is that the way you work too? Have you been able to develop that or is it kind of,
I wish, man.
Yeah.
No, it's gotten better. I would never compare myself to him. But Jimmy Pedro's son, AJ Pedro, who's wrestler at Brown, he's used me as a suplex bag for a while. for a couple of years now when he's been home, and you just get exposure to all these guys from that, you know, between Jimmy and Travis and that school over there.
So how do you keep it all straight? How do you not let it fall
bleed
in
from one to the next?
Yeah. How do you stop that?
A headspace, from what I understand, like wrestling feels very different in my head than jiu-jitsu does. I'm not allowed to do judo, so I wouldn't know.
Okay.
I got a no on that because they protect my hand so I can fix them all. If I break fingers, I can't fix their injuries.
Yeah.
Wrestling is so aggressive. It's really like,
wait a minute. What? You can't do judo to protect your hands, but you can do jiu-jitsu?
Yeah. Yeah, the grip breaks from standing in judo.
I know.
Are a little, yeah.
I know, you know. Yeah.
He often brings up these jokes.
I don't do judo as well. I can't make that argument.
What about
you gotta
wrist
talk
locks?
To Travis. I love wrist locks. Travis loves wrist locks too. But, you know, and he taught me how to tape the fingers so I could protect them well, judo style. But just practicing grip breaks in judo stand up, they're so aggressive that, you know, my fingers are already messed up. Travis said no. Like, damn it, Dad.
Boss says no, you don't
yeah.
do it.
Yeah, boss says no.
So it's got to be like a conscious decision then. I'm sitting down on the mat today and I'm doing jujitsu and my wrestling experience is not going to come into play?
Yes. Well, the big difference for me, the way I keep them separated, is jujitsu, the one that's better in the dojo, is the one that can do less work. If I can put in less effort and beat you, I'm winning in jujitsu. In wrestling, I'm winning if I'm outworking you. So that helps keep them separate. In wrestling, like, I'm never stopping. I'm constantly advancing my position until I've got the pin. And in jujitsu, I might hang out, in half guard for 2 minutes and work on just figuring out some levers and arm drags, or you get stalled out in closed guard for 10 minutes. Okay. That never happens in wrestling. There's no sit. So the headspace is just very different. The scramble headspace. Now, I can't say when I'm going against like Travis or Frosty or the higher level guys, I don't bring in the wrestling to help out. But I think that helps me keep it separate. As soon as I do jujitsu, I'm like,
Yeah, I had similar conversation with one of my students recently. Shout out to Pete, but he comes from heavy wrestling background. Matter of fact, he coaches wrestling, and so there's quite a bit of history on his part from a knowledge perspective and experience perspective. And he recently, started exploring jiu-jitsu and so on. And there's no question that the guy can mop the floor with everybody, on in that room. I mean, there's no question about that. However, interesting things come up when you start talking to him, because he tries to physically separate, not physically, mentally separate the two different skill sets. And, in order for him, one of the first things that he recognized early on is that in order for him to get good at jiu-jitsu or start even learning jiu-jitsu, is he needs to put wrestling aside because the rules of engagement are different. The way how both of the activities are done, there's a very different objective behind each. Plus, the rules are different. Like in wrestling, if you pinned, it's over. You go get your T-shirt and your towel and go home. See you on your way out. Versus in jiu-jitsu, it doesn't matter. You can pin me as much as you want. You can smash my face into the ground. It doesn't matter until we call it, right? So, interesting how even though the grappling component could be very similar. Matter of fact, if you compare jiu-jitsu grappling, no-gi grappling, to wrestling, there is a lot of bleed over. There's a lot of bleed. But because of the way how the sports or activities are organized from a rule set perspective and the rules of engagement, it creates such a black and white scenario. And everything changes at that point. Have you experienced something similar?
Yeah. I think also two wrestlers, my buddy Abe, Abraham Hunter, was at Maryland for wrestling, and one of my buddies, Craig Seidenglass, too. He wrestled at Baptist and Arizona for a while. They're all kind of in the same thing. Like, you start jiu-jitsu and you're like, oh my God, I'm really enjoying grappling. Like, you like wrestling when you're winning. And like when you're like, you're beating the shit out of someone else.
Yeah.
Jiu-jitsu's fun. It really is. And like that headspace, it's something that you just want to do for the rest of your life. Wrestling, it's hard. It's hard on the body and it's hard on your brain, being in that hyper aggressive state. Just with AJ, when I started getting back into it with him and being his dummy, doing referee's position, like escaping from referee's position, I'm like, oh right, like okay, like I forgot what it's like to like run from someone trying to maul you from behind and cross faces. Very different than jiu-jitsu, where I can just kind of curl up into a ball and create kind of like a cage. And the first thing Travis taught me was an inside heel hook on the first day. So my whole game was leg locks as a white belt. I didn't know anything else pretty much. And that got me so far away from wrestling, because it's literally the opposite. I'm going completely underneath someone that it gave me such like a totally different. And like now I'm pretty much completely a guard player because of that. And it gets me so far away from the wrestling headspace that, and I enjoy it way more.
Was that purposeful on Travis's part? Was he like, I'm getting the wrestling 100%. Out of this kid? Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Also, like, hey, this is a way that you can catch black belts right now.
Alternative motives.
Yeah. Yeah. This was like 7 years ago. And like the heel hook, the straight ankle, like the stuff, like people didn't really know. It's wild how crazy it's blown up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 7 years. That's a long, long,
yeah.
Long
whenever time. I get in those positions, being put in them, I'm like, ah, son of a mother, you know, it's like, geez, I got to learn this stuff. I got to learn it. And I don't.
Yeah.
So reaching back towards your professional life, let's talk about some of the physical components. I mean, there's no secret that jiu-jitsu is a physical engagement sport. There's a lot of bending, moving, you know, and it, no matter how chilled it is, there is still a lot of physicality to it, especially when we are put in these compromised positions like heel hooks. I mean, that's, you know, any type of joint leg manipulation, you know, puts us a lot of pressure, not only on the bones, but also on the muscles and ligaments and so on. You know, what is one to do in your mind from a coach perspective, really, to have this longevity in jiu-jitsu? I mean, everybody talks about, hey, listen, we can do jiu-jitsu until you be 70. You know, I'm going to die on the mat and all the other stuff. But we both know, actually, who was talking about wear and tear? Bernardo. We had Bernardo on the show.
Yeah.
You know, we had him on a show just a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about it's not the length, not the amount of time that you've been on the mat or you've been training, but the wear and tear is the mileage. Yeah. He called it a mileage, right? That really gets to you. So from coach perspective, as you deal with all these individuals, you know, what are your thoughts on really having the longevity in jiu-jitsu?
So that's as the Wu-Tang says, protect your neck. So like the spine, a bursa in general. So any of your bursa sacs in the body filled with synovial fluid, they're kind of like windows in cars. Everything else you can pretty much recover from. But, you know, nerve and bursa damage is where you have to be really concerned. So discs, you know, in the spine, meniscus issues you see last for a really long time. Those squishy discs, once they go, and it's why like meniscus repair, people are like, oh, it feels great. And you're like, you just took years off the knee. You know, it's kind of like the eyes and teeth. It's very hard for those tissues to recover and to heal. So that's always where I start first, as far as the wear and tear, not argument, but discussion, is like the neck is one of the hardest. You know, with advances, and I always stray away from a surgery. I rehabbed my own knee from an ACL tear without surgery. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. You have to be willing to put in a lot of work, because there's so much scar tissue when you get surgery, and especially in joint areas. So, the joints, specifically the sacs, the bursa, need to be taken care of the most. After that, it's very individual. And so you just start with like an overall look at how someone's joint work, if they're hypermobile, if they're not, right? It's a totally different way of dealing with them. But there are like general heuristics and guidelines that just go in like general ranges of motion. Make sure that shit works good, basically, that all your joints have the range of motion that they need.
So what can we do as individuals to put ourselves in the point of success, if you will, you know, to create these environments to really avoid injury? I mean, listen, nobody wants to get hurt. That's the obvious one, right? But we all do. Like, from bumps and bruises to some major things that really put us out for a long time and sometimes forever. Like, I know many guys who've been training jiu-jitsu or want to love jiu-jitsu, but they just can't do it because of the choices that we have made. So what can we do proactively?
So, return of investment wise, right? Time wise. It's like ice plunge and sauna are invaluable. Like, they are so important to your training and recovery schedule. If you want to be recovering just as much, you need a daily routine of movement and stretching. And it needs to be balanced, and it needs to be specifically created for your movement diet. So I have one that my friend makes for me, right? If we're our own coaches, we have a fool as the athlete is like, the, right? You have to outsource for your coaching because it's hard to see yourself, objectively. Mm-hmm. And you also don't want that burden. But you need to be in the morning moving and breathing for at least 10 to 15 minutes. You need to be changing the temperature that you're in. You can't be in climate controlled temperatures consistently. And you need to be running your system as much as possible in as many ways as possible. So like those three basics are probably the most important. And diet's the other one. That's a whole different conversation.
That's the one for me. It's the diet. I eat like trash. Wow. I really do all the time, man. That's something Travis and I have in common now, as we can sit on the couch and eat Cheetos. I'm going to send him messages next time.
The full funfetti cake before training is the
I just want to tell you, everything that you said in the past 3 minutes like went over his head.
I got it
like,
all.
He didn't get it right. It's completely hard. I'm surprised he's not yawning right now.
I'm into it. I'm hoping to get motivated. But I do. I like that athlete. Your athlete is a fool comment. Getting up in the morning, is it so? Schedules are always right. I think people use schedule as an excuse a lot. Right. I can't do it in the morning because I only have X amount of time before work. Instead of saying getting up 15 minutes earlier, you know, so I can't do it. But like here, I mean, most of the training, most of what I do is always at night, and it's always late at night.
Yep.
And then I'm sitting on the couch.
Jiu-jitsu guy.
Right. And so to get back to like that diet thing too, is like, okay, so now I'm amped, I'm wired, I'm home at 10:30 now, sitting on the couch, and that those Cheetos are calling me, right? Mm-hmm. And is it just, is there things that you could do throughout the day, I guess, to lessen that temptation or that those
diet wise?
So I wouldn't
speak so much as like the cravings are usually come from sleep deprivation, which is fairly inevitable with the jiu-jitsu training schedule, unfortunately. And naps are very important if you're training a lot. Something that people don't talk about at the highest level because it makes them sound a little bit soft, but professional athletes should be taking naps. Your training schedule is so intense. And if you're training late at night, take a 20-minute, 30-minute nap during the day. Make that time, even if it's like half your lunch. It is so much better than a cup of coffee. And if you replace one for the other, you'll notice incredible improvements with the cravings in specific. Now, as far as food goes, if you look into Weston A. Price's work, kind of again, genetics are everything. So like a one size fit all diet is never going to work. You watch all this crap with keto, with like, the South Beach diet, right? People are doing Atkins. It's so individual. You're going to figure out what works for you. Really, the only thing that works is an elimination diet if you want to go that intense. But if we're starting with base willpower, figure out quality of ingredient, get the best possible ingredients that you can, and just eat whatever you want from those ingredients. But if you change the quality of ingredient, that will be the biggest return of investment for lifestyle and how you feel.
Let me ask you this. Everybody who is listening to this, thousands of people, they are like, this guy works with athletes. I'm not an athlete. I'm just a jiu-jitsu guy. I'm gonna chill, I'm gonna roll a couple times a week. Who cares? Is everything that you're saying right now applicable, truly applicable to average Joe Schmo out there, or are you truly referring to Travis Stevens, to some of the top level guys?
So it depends on the Joe Schmo. You know, the classic archetype with jiu-jitsu guys, specifically hobbyists, are that they're very successful in other fields, not jiu-jitsu, but in like, let's say, business, or they're sometimes artists at a really high level, right? They're experts at, the reason that they enjoy jiu-jitsu so much is because of the problem solving. Engineers is one of the biggest, group of people that we get in jiu-jitsu. These are professionals. You know, they may not be professionals in jiu-jitsu, but they're professionals. So all of the same advice applies 100%. You know, I think jujitsu is one of those things that helps them recover from being professionals in other fields. Like, you know, it's the rare individual that you get that's kind of the bum jujitsu guy. It's kind of an archetype. But as you get older, those tend to like disappear for one reason or another.
Interesting.
Well, I'm stuck in this. I'm going to use our time here for me. All right. I'm really stuck in this rut.
You know
of
what?
Like,
while you're doing it, I'm going to go take a nap.
Okay. and I think this happens to a lot of people is you get up and you get your day going, whatever that means. Right. So it's grab something quick, probably something unhealthy, your cup of coffee, you're out the door. Right. And then you're at your 9 to 5. Which is probably more than 8 hours, right? You're sitting in the car, then you're at work, then you're sitting in the car, then you're back at jujitsu. And it just seems like, you know, you get in when you're in that constant revolving door over and over and over again. I think even for the hobbyist, it's like, it really affects your jujitsu. It really affects your mental state of getting to the gym, doing it while you're on the mat. And other than like self-motivation, I feel like it's really hard to break that cycle. Is there any advice? Is there anything just, you know, quit being a bitch, get up early, do it. Are there actual like steps that you could, if you do this, if you add this to your routine, it's really going to benefit that hobbyist, that type of person.
I mean,
and I know that's really a specific thing to ask you.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Besides like the basic, like go to sleep earlier, you know, like Jocko wakes up at 4, but he goes to sleep at 8, you know, it's one of those.
You never see the watch that says 8 p.m., right?
Like, 8 p.m., yeah. But that's like, that's what he should be showing, I think. You know, it's like, hey guys, I'm, you know, this is why I'm able to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to set yourself up for success in a lot of ways, but you know, breaking habits is incredibly difficult. And it really comes down to like, there are a bunch of the tricks, like put a sticker on your bathroom mirror, because it's the place that you look the most in the morning. Like as soon as you go to the bathroom in the morning, like those mnemonic devices to kind of like cue you in to start pushing yourself is a good one, or on the ceiling above your bed. Like there are a bunch of those. You know, I have an alarm that I have people use that make you solve math in the morning to turn it off. Nice. You know, there are ways to do it. Yeah, it's, that one's brutal.
I bet.
But
yeah. Man, talk
does,
about
does anybody now? I gotta ask: does anybody even solve the thing, or they just toss the phone across the room?
You have to turn the phone off to turn it off. No, it's you gotta solve it. Or it doesn't stop.
That's brilliant.
Brutal. And again, I did it for a while to learn it. You know, and it wakes you up. It works. there are many very instinctual methods, but play to your strengths. If it works more to you to run at night than to run in the morning, I think putting that in a negative connotation, I don't think that it's very mental. Like, if you think it's going to be negative for you, of course it's going to be negative for you. You know, you're putting yourself in a negative headspace. If you look at yourself and you go, hey, it's 10 o'clock at night and I can't sleep right now, it's 11 o'clock, I'm going to go for a run. I'm going to go get a lift. I'm going to go swim. I'm going to practice some solo movement at home. I'm going to stretch. Do that. Do it when you have time and when you have energy. You know, trying to force yourself into the same pattern that everyone else lives in because it seems healthy. Again, I think it's quality of intake, whether it's information or, you know, ingredients, so to speak, is going to be the number one dictator of success.
And I think we often talk, at least I hear this and I have these conversations with my students often, is, you know, how do you improve even in jiu-jitsu? And it's all about changing habits. It doesn't matter what you do. And correct me if I'm wrong, you're the professional here, but it's all about changing a habit. It's all about changing a pattern that has been engraved in our brain for a very long time. So changing that process is extremely difficult, especially if we are trying to make it like a forklift change, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm gonna stop eating all the pizza and all the beer. Who was the Marcio Cruz, right?
Yeah.
Marcio Cruz. Yeah. But it's like, I'm gonna stop eating all that and I'm gonna eat vegetables only.
Yeah, does it? I mean, I feel like that doesn't work. It doesn't. It's gotta be incremental, right?
It's I mean, unless you have a titanic willpower, it's gonna be, I mean, I know people that could do that for a period of time for sure, but you know, you're going to be so exhausted every day from making those decisions. You know, like, really, you see like people who are very, very successful in business, they wear like the same thing every day. It's usually like a white shirt and jeans, like the really, really successful people, like the guys that you never know that they're billionaires, but they take away the decision-making process for themselves. They just get a bunch of the same stuff. Because every time you make a decision during the day, you get drained of energy. And so the more decisions you're making, you know, and it's so much easier to say yes to yourself is the other thing, instead of saying no. So instead of saying, I'm not going to do something, just replace it with something else. This is the easiest. It's the environmental change theory when it comes to like addiction, addictive personalities, just get addicted to something else. You know, a lot of jiu-jitsu guys specifically have incredibly, well, I think any athlete that consistently comes back, you know, you have to have an obsessive, is another way to say it, personality to some extent. And you just try to use that for good. So, you know, finding health food that you really enjoy. And instead of saying, I can't eat Cheetos, you know, I get to eat beef jerky instead. You know, that's, you fix something, but you're not suffering. You know, you're saying yes to yourself. That's why, like, you know, making those pauses when you wake up in the morning, if you get up early, reward yourself, you know, give yourself 10 minutes, sit down with a cup of coffee, you know, listen to an audio book that you like, give yourself something. It's important to reward yourself, and reinforce those habits instead of just punishing you. You know, the David Goggins approach only works for a couple individuals.
Oh, you just broke Thomas's heart.
No.
Whether I think it works.
Whether one agrees or not, this guy is insane. And there was, I mean, but listen, like, you know, he's insane one, but like Jocko Willing is not much different. Like, I don't think he is. I mean, waking up at 4 a.m. and doing the things that he does, it's phenomenal motivation for external viewer, right? But to do this for years or decades takes a lot of dedication, and that makes him insane. I'm sorry. I love both of them. I think they're huge. There are people who change the way how we think about things, you know? But
100%. And for people that have a lot of demons, I think they're very important. Like, I watch Jocko and I watch David Goggins. Now you listen to Can't Hurt Me specifically because he reads the audiobook, mm-hmm. or you listen to like Extreme Ownership. Cause again, like, you know, like his experiences, Jocko's in Ramadi, like incredible, incredible life experience, incredible amounts of PTSD, just like immense amounts of trauma. Like, this dude is taming his demons. And same with Goggins. And so for people who are stuck in really dark places, you know, so I think the same with Wim Hof, you know, with his path. And I got to meet him in New York and did a seminar down there. And, you know, like, these people are so inspiring. And for those that, you know, are living and suffering constantly in this place of just pain with demons, that those people are beacons of light. So I don't want to take anything away, for you know, the average Joe Schmo, it might be difficult to come up with enough like anger to constantly run a marathon every morning. But you know, like, I don't think it's impossible either. And hey, man, I'll get up in the morning sometimes, throw on, you know, a David Goggins, you know, Stay Hard video, or a Jocko, like Jocko's Good, you know, conversation, and it helps a lot.
So we talk quite a bit about recovery and the good habits and changing habits and having these positive processes in place in order for us to stay successful. I do want to talk to you briefly about doing things ahead of the training. So whether we're doing judo, wrestling, or training, you know, how do we set ourselves for success ahead of time? You know, whether that's you briefly talked about stretching routine in the morning or movement routine in the morning, but let's take this a little bit down to earth to kind of average Joe Schmo. What do we need to do? I'm going to the academy. Let's just say 3 times a week. You know, nothing extraordinary. I'm not going to be a world champion. I'm not looking for Olympic gold medals. I just want to roll. I just want to learn. I just want to continue doing this. What do I need to do in order for me to be successful long term and really make a positive impact on myself?
I think headspace work. Like, the more I work with the higher level athletes, and I mean, this was always the same with this is where the wilderness stuff came in a lot. It's like, you have to prepare your head more than your body. You have to prepare your head. I think the jiu-jitsu warm-ups at the beginning, you know, you're learning those basic movements, but you're also just learning how to think jiu-jitsu, like just be in that location in the mental landscape is another way to put it. So, you know, when I have my athletes come into the lifting gym to lift and exercise, we always start with the same couple stretches at the beginning. And it's just a cue. It's a cue to start thinking we're going to lift now. Like, we're going to be stretching. We're going to start using maximum effort. When they come in the gym and we start doing hip escapes and shrimps and, you know, forward rolls and shots, it's a way to start thinking jiu-jitsu. I think that's the most important. You prepare your body with your mental state and your focus. So as far as doing things every morning, you know, keeping your mind prepared to go into that space, I think is the biggest thing as far as return of investment of what you're putting into it.
That explains why purple belts skip warm-ups.
Yeah. He wanted
to. I'm just saying. Shout out to all the purple belts.
Yeah, you know who you are. We'll see you 15 minutes after class starts.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And wrestlers too, like, you teach wrestling classes after they're not in school anymore wrestling, and they'll show up 15, 20 minutes late consistently, like, take a while putting on their shoes. Like, when are we drilling?
Oh,
like,
don't even start me on this guy.
I have guys
who will literally be the first one at the academy. They'll show up 10 minutes before class, and somehow magically they are late. They are the last one out of the locker room. Lord.
Yep.
I have people who literally say, quote, "I'm going to hang out in the office for a minute because I don't want to be out there yet. I got here. Traffic wasn't bad. I got here too early. Yeah. And they'll hang out in the office for 10 minutes.
They stand next to you as you coach and just try to talk to you instead of warming up.
But on a serious note, what is the importance of visualizing these things and getting yourself into that mental state of doing what you're about to do, whether it's judo, wrestling, or jiu-jitsu, preparing your mind to be open-minded enough where you can maximize your success on the mat?
So meditation could be summed up with two things. First, it's focus, and then it's imagination. That's it. So when you talk about mental training, to speak, like, that's what the cold plunges are doing when you're focusing on your breath. Same with the sauna, is you're just honing your focus. You know, Vipassana, the 10-day meditations, kind of the entry to real intensive meditation training. They just have you focus on the tip of the nose, essentially, for 10 days straight. Anytime you lose attention, you focus back on the tip of the nose. And once you've cultivated that type of focus, then you start to use it for mental training. Then you get your mental reps in. But by far the most useful way of you know, mental prep that I've found, and through Travis and through some other people, you know, Travis's wife, Kalita, who I trained for 4 years leading up to Tokyo as well, she's on the Canadian Olympic team, is to put yourself in the shoes that you would be in on the mat. Or no shoe, right? For judo, it's not wrestling shoes. It's barefoot, but the feel of the mat under your feet, the feel of the gi on you, the smell of the mats, the what it feels like to be there, rather than, I think what most people do is like the mental reps where they're doing the move over and over in their head and they're imagining what they're going to do on the mat instead of just being present in your head on the mats and how that makes you feel. Or, you know, in anything that you're training for, whether that's, you know, I don't know, engineering, how that applies to anything else. But for me, very specifically, it's the woods. Like with training, you know, people in wilderness survival to get them accustomed to it, I'd have them head out into the woods and sit for 1 hour in one spot without moving every day in the same spot until they knew that place perfectly by memory. And then they could focus on it and go there at any time, kind of like a mental palace idea.
And then you just start adding, right? You just start building on it, layering on top. And then
it's your foundation. Yeah. It's just being able to imagine things, right? Like focus, keep your focus for any period of time and your attention span, increase your attention span, and then be able to, you know, kind of just work up there and have like open space to imagine and think and be creative.
Without getting out there and sitting there, how do you distance yourself from everything in your city life, your day-to-day life? If you can't get out there, do you just do it in your head? Is it meditation?
Yeah, it's a lot of meditation. I sleep on mats. So one of the reasons that I was biology and chemistry double major and, had massive stomach surgery and was in the hospital for 3 weeks and they cut my entire abdomen open, took out everything, put everything back in. And so recovering from that is really what led me down the path of therapy. You know, I have bad back problems if I don't meditate, take that time, stretch, move, and sleep on hard surfaces. So every night and every morning is kind of like a ritual, with meditation. Sam Harris is the best one I found so far. His app Waking Up is what I have my clients do at this point. If I can't kind of coach them through it one-on-one, is a great, I would suggest that to pretty much to everyone.
How often you go out in the wilderness?
Right now, maybe once every 2 weeks. My dad is up in Vermont and my sister's on the West Coast, but I'll head up there. There's a camp up in New Hampshire where we go hunting, getting to the season. But usually when I have athletes now, I'll take up Ryan Russo from the gym. We've got a bunch. It's like we're in a development space now with USA Judo. So we got Project 2024 and a lot of those kids who are showing a lot of promise, but they're young. They're still in high school. So, they're not quite at the age where I'm going to take them for a week, 2 weeks up there and kind of stick them out by themselves or even just do ice plunge training in the winter. But we have an ice plunge at the place and, spend as much time outside as possible.
We have a lot of people talking about the ice plunge here on the mats and there's always a lot of, back and forth about it. And I think some people don't really get it. If you could explain it just a little bit more, coming from you, I think it'll hit home for people.
Yeah. It's dependent on the individual. So people find different things. Basically, it's just teaching you to relax. There are a bunch of physiological effects that are incredible, like, burning brown fat adipose and getting, basically supporting your body bringing it out of its comfort zone. And temperature is such a overlooked comfort zone that we just accept, and I think that's to our detriment on both sides, getting this climate controlled environment that we live in, where like that door clicks closed behind you and you're perfectly safe in your house with the door locked, everything's exactly 70 degrees, I think is one of the major reasons for disease. We just don't have that constant interaction with change. So we stagnate in many ways. The ice bath is extreme. So I always progressively resist everything. Don't go out and just start trying to jump into an ice bath for 10 minutes straight. Cold showers first, slowly turn down that shower, get used to it slowly and slowly and slowly, slower, get yourself there and learn how to breathe really well. There's a lot of the Tummo breathing, the kind of the Wim Hof style, the intense breathing, and then like the fire breathing that you see like Hicks and Gracie do with the Kundalini yoga breathing. There's so many different types of breathing. Find one that works for you. I would be my best advice. There's no one size fit all. But But getting out of your comfort zone is the basis of it. I can go into details on the science side of stuff, but it's still such a, we've done some studies on it, but, and it doesn't need to be that cold. Anything below 60 degrees is going to get you the effect you're looking for. Just make sure you don't do it right after training would be my biggest advice.
So when should you do it?
At least an hour after training. If you do it directly after training, there's some really significant studies showing currently that you basically just delay. You don't get like hypertrophy from the body. The body's going through an inflammatory process after training because you just broke down tissue. You just remodeled a bunch of stuff. Your body's learning. And that cold, just like throwing an ice pack on right after an injury. You know, if it's an injury past your ability to recover from it, like, you know, you popped your knee, throw ice on immediately. You want to decrease that swelling because it'll be an overreaction. But when it's a good reaction after training, you want that. You want that muscle growth. You want that learning process. So don't interrupt it. Wait for an hour. You can jump in the sauna. You can heat your body up more, but delay yourself from cooling it down. It's also going to be too easy to get into the ice bath. It's going to feel relieving. You don't want it to be easy. You want it to be uncomfortable. You want to overcome some sort of discomfort, which is part of it.
Mind-blowing amount of information.
Well, is this theory correct? My wife hates the cold weather, hates it, right? And whenever she's out in the cold, she's shivering, she's, you know, and it's just awful. I've been able, and I don't mind the cold, and I think the reason I don't is because, one, I run little errands all the time with just, you know, a hoodie, right? When it's 30 degrees out or less. I've acclimated myself to it. But the other thing is, I think what you were saying earlier about breathing is I don't tense up and shiver when I'm cold. I make myself relax, sit comfortably if I'm sitting or walk comfortably, you know, and I think that, is that a parallel there? That we're, you know, what we're talking about?
Yeah. With the cold, you have to go into it. Same with the heat. Like, if you run away from the environment, it will catch you. Mm-hmm. Like, the wilderness survival we talk about the threes. You have 3 hours without shelter, 3 minutes without oxygen, 3 hours without shelter, and 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. Exposure is the most dangerous besides oxygen loss. So for the body, it's a huge ROI because when your body's that cold, immediately you go through something called the shell core factor, where your body pulls blood away from the extremities to the organs to save yourself. And turning that around and telling your body to relax and sending blood back out and that you're not going to die. And that's what stops you from getting cold. As soon as your body thinks you're going to die and you flex, then you start to die. That's how it works. And so instead of running away from the cold, going into the cold, same with the heat, you know, like start doing push-ups in the sauna. As soon as you feel like you're going to overheat, get hotter. Like push yourself to go further in those directions. And you'll actually find that it's more comfortable. You know, it's more uncomfortable to resist the process than it is to just surrender.
Cool.
And yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I finally gave somebody some good advice.
and I'm going to get blamed now for siding with you.
I'll play that clip over and over again. We got a couple more months before it starts getting cold. And
you get taken out from 100 yards away.
Scott, I don't know if you've noticed, but I stayed quiet. I see his wife a couple times a week, and no. I'm staying out of that conversation. No. Hello, okay, Margaret. I hope you have a great day, Margaret. The thermostat. I hope you're doing well.
Well, you know what's fun, too, is we're coming up on that time of the year where I'm like, no, we're not turning the heat on. We're not turning – and, you know, and then she'll hit me with – like when it gets below 60 in the house, she'll hit me with it's not fair to the kids. And that one gets me every time. It's like, all right.
She knows how to play the system. The other thing
is very important is girls always tend towards heat. So, like, it's a vast generalization. I may get in trouble. I don't care. Like, girls will always tend towards, if you get in, like, the shower and it's on a preset after you know, your significant other or, you know, if you're in the gym and, like, a girl uses the gym shower before you, like, you burn. It's you know, we tend to run cooler and they tend to run hotter. Mm-hmm. So when I'm getting women into, you know, it depends on what we have. If it's the winter in New England, ice bath is too convenient. It's easy. You just stick some water outside and break the ice off in the morning. But, you know, I'll always tell women to go towards heat first, because it's easier for them to get into that and then get into the extreme, you know, temperature training through that, and then use ice bath as contrast once they're overheating, where vice versa for guys. I'll start them out with the cold, and then guys tend to do better with the cold. I think it's just, yeah. It's
something in our makeup, fat, right? Yeah. I don't know.
So yeah.
Cool.
Multivariable, probably.
We are not as tough as they are. That's all.
No, true. I think it's the opposite is true. And now I'm going to get fucked.
See,
you walked into
I'm
that one.
I'm absolutely going there. You walked into that one.
I was trying to play nice right now.
It's one of the few things that I can hold over her is that I can take the cold. And I don't know why I'm bringing this up, but so one.
Keep
so
going. This was, is going to be a great episode.
It was a brutal winter. It was a polar vortex. Winter, it was below zero all the time, or in, you know, in the teens or below for weeks on end here in the city. And I went out on the back porch. She was already in bed. I went out on the back porch in my t-shirt, my underwear, nothing else on. And I just stood there for as long as I could take it. She was asleep, and I slid into bed and I put my arms around her and I put my feet on her legs.
That's so wrong.
She screamed, and then
hitting
she said,
elbow. Yeah.
No, she screamed and said, "Jesus Christ, what's wrong with you? You need a doctor." She had no idea what I did. I've done things like that a couple times, and it's been quite a few years. So I think this winter, we're getting back to it.
The couch is where you're staying tonight. Yes, for sure.
And I will be sure to say, Scott, like, got me motivated to be cold again, and she's just going to have to suffer.
For those of you who are listening to the show, this might be the last time we hear from Gary.
Yeah,
so
that's all right. She doesn't do me a favor. She doesn't listen, so don't bring it up.
Oh,
that's
I will send it to her. Send it to her.
That's good.
Right, wouldn't be friends if he didn't blast this on every form.
Exactly.
Scott, mind-blowing amount of information. Before we, you know, start wrapping this up.
Yeah, that's been over an hour.
Yeah, over an hour. Before we start wrapping this up, end of each episode, what we do is a guest who was previous to you sitting in your chair and having that similar conversation to us asked a question for you, not knowing that you will be answering it. And so it happens that guest was quite a jiu-jitsu personality. Gary's going to take a lead on this.
So
let's take a look what the question is.
Huron Gracie wants to know. Wow. Yeah, I know, right?
No pressure.
He wants to know, what position are you the least comfortable in, or what do you avoid?
In life or in jiu-jitsu?
Let's do both.
Yeah, there you
let's
go.
Let's do both.
Let's do both. So I think in life, I think the thing I'm most uncomfortable in and is debt.
Debt, you know, like financial debt?
In anything. So in you know, owing someone something as well, favors, like not being the one that's able to give, if that makes sense. Not being in a position of freedom in my ability to help and assist and be useful. And be a man, right? Like all the important things for me, being responsible. So that, and that's what I avoid at highest cost, is being a burden. And especially to friends and family, but also to myself. And then in jiu-jitsu, honestly, the position I avoid the most probably has to be right now, inversions, because of wrestling and my neck injuries and what I know about the neck. You know, I'm very bendy, I'm very loose. And what I see the most with jiu-jitsu guys now too, is just the, and with that purple belt wear and tear, is you get to that point of like, oh, like I'm hitting my Barambolo entries. I'm like going underneath, you know, your tornado sweeps and like using your neck against their entire body weight. And you know, the wear and tear is so high in those positions. And you know, you see it with people getting, you know, neck replacements, disc replacements all the time. I would say the thing that I avoid most is that, because I know, you know, that's the thing that's going to wear out the quickest on me and it's going to stop me from rolling is if I sacrifice my spine position in position to advance. So
let me ask you this. Do you think that your knowledge about human body and everything that you do and mental space, do you think that's a benefit to you, or is it actually an obstacle because you have this knowledge and you can predict what could happen? You know, sometimes the ignorance is a bliss, right? Like if we don't know things, it's just, we don't know things. You know, it is mm-hmm. what it is. And you do have that knowledge. Do you think that stops you often from doing things or achieving the goals that you want to achieve?
No, I would say yes and no. I think it's hugely helpful to get from point A to point B. Like jujitsu, you know, in class with Travis, he's like, Scott, what's this nerve called again? And he's like grinding down on it, demoing a move. And it's like your axial nerve. Like that's what you're doing there in that armbar position, is you're just grinding on the axial nerve or pain taps or that stuff's very helpful. I think it's useful more than it's not useful. I think people understanding their bodies is very important. I know gymnastic natural, like is a huge discipline of the Gracies. And it's very much, and yoga, all of that stuff. It's very important to understand what's going on inside. If you're going to be applying it, and using it on others, and jujitsu is a vehicle to learn that. You know, when I do therapy, a lot of my therapy is jujitsu. I'm doing submissions light to chest joint ranges and to work on joint ranges. So I think it's helpful. That being said, you know, I never really wanted to compete at high levels. I really enjoyed, you know, the art of coaching. And you know, what we're doing right now, this kind of like, just working through things, asking questions, building knowledge base, but having other people go try it, you know, and just working on problems. I'm interested in the problems and the solutions more in the lines of like the physical body than the jiu-jitsu chess game, if that makes sense. So for me, it's very useful.
What do you say to the white belt or the blue belt that just doesn't tap, that they're in that headspace, dude, of I'm not going to tap no matter what?
That never happens. All blue belts and white belts tap. What are you talking about?
And this is the thing, like wrestling, as starting with wrestling and then going to jiu-jitsu, you always get messed up. Like I have no UCLs anymore. I've got one ACL. Like it's just, it is what it is. Because you're so used to waiting for the ref mm-hmm. to stop you. So it's this ingrained thing where you just like, you're waiting for like, you know, either them to let go, because they've decided that you're pinned, or, you know, the ref to stop it. And so it takes a while. And the wrestling headspace is like, you know, F you. The more you can tap, the better. I mean, don't tap to pressure. Don't tap to, you know, non. And that's why it is important to know what is dangerous and what is not dangerous. Yeah. You know, for me, if you're getting smothered, deal with it. You know, you can last for 3 minutes without oxygen. You'll be fine. But if you're in a dangerous position, just get out of it and restart. Tap as many times as you can. And then later on, if you want to test those positions, go for it. But
yeah, I think the important point you touch on is understanding what is happening around you, what the surroundings are. You know, just because somebody's on top of you, why are you tapping? And like it, and there's nothing wrong with tapping. Please don't misunderstand me out there. But like understanding why you're tapping is really important. Somebody's on top of you, you're not comfortable, you want to stop, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that, but I understand why it happened. Did they submit you, or were you just not ready to be there. Like, those are two different things, right? If nobody's mm-hmm. punching you, nobody's choking you, nobody's breaking any joints, what's the discomfort, right? And if there is no risk, can we eliminate that? Can we move along? Can we adjust? Can you protect yourself and then escape and then attack, destroy, smash?
Well, the reason I brought it up is because I want people to look at the longevity of being on the mats. And I think those guys, you know, they're usually younger, but actually I'm going to take that back. They're not usually younger because it could be somebody coming in here with a lot of, they think they have something to prove, an older person.
It's not even that. I don't know.
To themselves. Something to prove to themselves. I'm not going to tap no matter what.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, you're going to wonder why 6 months down the road, why your back hurts all the time, your neck hurts all the time. And it's not because of any, the only thing that you're not doing is tapping when somebody's, you know. So just do it.
Especially, I think, and I don't mean to categorize people, but it's like, I want to be politically correct here. But listen, especially with guys, we have, there's so much testosterone going on when we spar, and the ego, whether we like it or not, I don't care what you say. We do have ego. Yeah. We have big egos. Oh, yeah. We don't want to lose. We want to. I have a huge ego. You know, it's just, the point is, can you manage it? That's the point, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with resisting and going hard applying pressures to your partner. The point is, at which point you understand what is really happening. Because if you push past that point, that's where the injuries happen. And this is why I think a lot of lower belts, unfortunately, find themselves in those positions. It's not that they don't want to tap particular, like, you know, it's not about the tap itself. They don't want to lose.
Right.
I think that's the point.
They think that tapping is losing.
They're losing, exactly. Yeah. Versus looking at it, you know, slightly different angle. And unfortunately, I think a lot of this comes from the experience and being on a mat and going through these motions. And, you know, listen, I remember 20 years
ago. Thomas used to be really, really hard-headed, is all the stories I get from the guys that knew him when he was in his 20s.
I publicly really say this. There's no
bad
secret.
Training partner. He was a bad training partner.
I sucked as a training partner. Sucked.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to train me. I mean, unfortunately, but, you know, I learned the hard way, and it is what it is. But, you know, but also times were different back then. Like, that's the reality, you know, the camp that I was brought up in, it was, you literally destroy a, go get a hot dog. Like, it is what it is. There was no, similar to what you're talking about with wrestling rooms. Like, just the mental state in the room was very different than what it is today. Today we are kind of like, hey, peas, you know, I had a hard day, let's chill and roll. And that's great. You know, I love that environment too. But just understanding where the limitations are and what we should and should not do in those specific positions, I think is really, really important. Scott, we've been at this this might be the longest episode we've done. Jeez.
Really?
We've had some more.
This is a good conversation. I love the fact that you're so open to share all this information. By the way, I just saw your Instagram. You had a Pete the Greek at your place?
Yeah.
shout out to Pete. Pete is the man.
He's a Greek brother. He saw the last name, and we started getting along immediately.
Pete was here a couple months ago. We had a good time.
Pete is the man.
Yeah.
So movement as medicine. That's the place to go to learn more and to contact you.
No. Not movement as medicine. Movement as medicine. I used to work with them, but the place to go is the Instagram account, and then Fuji Martial Arts in Woburn is where I coach and teach out of there. Now I do therapy out of there as well. And then BJJ Fanatics has the videos on there, you know, with, you know, ones with Travis and the other two, most of them are, and then the under 51 is coming out, I think, in 2 to 3 weeks. This was a promo. So, coaching over 50. But the other ones are all like assessing the spine and back we have on there. One that like will show you exactly what to do to get stronger in those specific, kind of like sports specific judo training. And then we have a base grappling, just longevity one with Travis on there.
Well, as always, we'll include all the links in the show notes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if this conversation was something to trigger thoughts in your mind, and, you know, one, check out Scott on Instagram. Two, go to BJJ Fanatics, get his stuff. And then two, can anybody contact you? Are you actually active on social media, or if anybody wants to drop you a line?
Yep. That's how you got in contact with me.
I sure did. You just ruined it. I felt special for a moment. I felt special for a moment.
Dive into the DMs. Yeah. No, thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for helping out. I think people are going to benefit a lot from this. I know I'm going to go home and try and eat right.
You might be dead by this evening. Right. That's what might happen.
Unless you say something when she's here later
today.
Make
sure you check in on him, man. Yeah.
She's going to be coming through the door at about 3:45.
Yeah. So, next episode, I'm flying Scott in here. He's going to take over because you are not around.
He's already got the clip sent to her.
All right, Scott, let's wrap this up. Thanks for being here. As always, we'll be watching you from the sidelines, and good luck with everything that you do. And as always, keep in touch.
All right. Thank you, man. Peace.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Raw Radio. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review and help us make the show even more amazing. For future episodes, check out our website and follow us on all major podcast platforms. Take care.